Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jeff Weber from New York University, and to begin, I asked him about key data sets evaluating adjuvant immunotherapy and targeted therapy presented at the 2017 ESMO meeting.
The good news was the data were presented at ESMO, actually, in Madrid, and for the first time, the mature data from two large randomized trials. One was the CheckMate 238 trial that I presented, and the other was the COMBI-AD trial, which was presented by Axel Hauschild. Why don't we start with the targeted therapy first? That was a large randomized trial of over 800 patients who were randomly allocated to receive either dabrafenib and trametinib, which are the BRAF and MEK drugs that are approved over the last couple of years for metastatic disease, versus placebo in a trial that was done internationally. But what distinguished that trial was that they had stage 3A, 3B, and 3C patients. They did not have stage 4 resected patients. It was only stage 3. And that's a pretty high-risk population on average. You figure it's at least a 50% risk of relapse at 5 years. The good news there is that there was a major difference in both relapse-free and overall survival in that trial, of course, favoring dabrafenib and trametinib versus placebo. And if you look at the p-value for the difference, it was probably the smallest p-value ever seen. It was listed on the slide that Axel Hauschild presented. It was 0.000000000001. So there were actually 13 zeros in front of the decimal point. So it was incredibly clearly positive in terms of relapse-free survival. And if you look at the overall survival, there was enough follow-up, and the follow-up was about 3 years in all patients, to be able to calculate a survival benefit, which was clearly present.
What was the hazard rate?
The hazard ratio was about 0.5. I think it was 0.48. And if you break it down by substage, by almost any other indicator amongst the subgroups on the forest plots, the hazard ratios remained highly favorable and all clustered around 0.5. They were between 0.48 and 0.55.
Now that's for survival or progression-free survival?
For relapse-free survival, whether it was stage 3A, stage 3B, stage 3C, clear advantage for dabrafenib and trametinib versus placebo. And the survival advantage also held, although because there was less follow-up for survival than for relapse-free survival, the p-values were not as favorable. But nonetheless, clear advantage for dabrafenib and trametinib without question versus placebo in the adjuvant mode in stage 3 resected melanoma.
Now, for how long was the therapy given?
It was given for 1 year and then everyone stopped. And of course, these are two oral drugs, dabrafenib twice a day, trametinib once a day. And the surprising thing, though, was when you look at the side effects, generally, we feel these are fairly well-tolerated drugs, but something like 26% of patients had to stop because of a drug-related or treatment-related toxicity. A little surprising, and the toxicities were the ones you would expect that we've seen in metastatic disease. It was fevers, nausea, diarrhea, liver function abnormalities, fatigue, but 26% is a fair rate, and again, a bit surprising. And one wonders whether the toxicity is looked at differently in the adjuvant mode where, frankly, many patients will be cured just sitting there compared to the metastatic mode where patients, obviously, who don't get treated will do poorly.
Well, also, you know, in terms of people coming off therapy, I would think maybe a significant number got a few months of therapy or even 6 months of therapy, so maybe it wasn't like nothing.
No, I agree. The people who stopped tended to get between 3 and 6 months of therapy, and you wonder whether that was enough. Now, when you compare those data, which had relapse-free and overall survival curves that separated and pretty much stayed separated, there was no, quote, banana-shaped curve like we saw on that BRIM-8 trial, which, again, were data that were also presented at ESMO. In fact, there was a presidential symposium where there were three adjuvant trials. COMBI-AD, I just described, which was dabrafenib, trametinib versus placebo. BRIM-8 was vemurafenib alone, that's the BRAF drug, versus placebo. And there you didn't see as favorable a result because it was an unusual trial. It segregated the stage 3C patients, and there were only a modest number of them. There were a couple of hundred patients who got randomized. And if that had been positive, then the entire trial would be reported out. It turned out in the stage 3C patients for vemurafenib alone, it was not a positive trial. The relapse-free survival curves came together and the p-value was not favorable, and the hazard ratio was quite poor. So unfortunately, that was not a positive trial. And on the other hand, who would think that using a BRAF inhibitor alone, which is almost never done in metastatic disease, would be appropriate as adjuvant therapy? So that, unfortunately, was a pretty low impact situation, and those data have not yet been published. COMBAD was published in the New England Journal simultaneously with the presentation at ESMO in Madrid. And then that brings us to the other trial, which is actually the one that I presented, and that was also simultaneously published in the New England Journal, where somewhat different adjuvant trial. There it was nivolumab, the PD-1 blocking antibody, versus an active control of ipilimumab, the CTLA-4 blocking antibody. As we all know, CTLA-4 antibody ipilimumab is approved by the FDA for resected high-risk stage 3 melanoma in the United States. It's not approved outside the U.S., but it is an approved drug, and it is used somewhat as adjuvant therapy in the United States for resected high-risk melanoma. And that was based on a trial where there have been published survival and relapse-free survival data favoring ipilimumab versus placebo. Those are all data published in the New England Journal back in 2016, where we saw that there was clearly a survival advantage to getting ipilimumab versus getting a placebo. The current trial, which was called CheckMate 238, which was the one presented just a month ago at ESMO in Madrid, was nivolumab versus ipilimumab. And in that trial, there was clearly an advantage in every way, shape, or form for nivolumab versus the active control of ipilimumab. The hazard ratio was actually quite favorable. It was 0.66 or 0.65. The p-value for relapse-free survival was 0.0001. Not 13 zeros, but still a very good p-value. And a good hazard ratio, which reflects a 35% decrease in the risk of relapsing over time for nivolumab compared to ipilimumab.
And again, for how long was the therapy?
Again, therapy lasted 1 year, and there are a couple of caveats. This was a trial that was stopped at its first interim analysis, which was pre-planned. And here you only had 18 months of follow-up in all patients compared to COMBAD, where you had 3 years plus of follow-up. So for the CheckMate 238 Nivo versus Ipi trial, you really didn't have any mature survival data. In fact, very, very few patients died, which is good. So you had no comparison of survival, but you did have relapse-free survival, and you had another parameter, which is very important, which a lot of folks think is a close surrogate for overall survival, and that's distant metastasis-free survival. And in that study, clearly nivolumab was favored, and again, the p-value was 0.02, and the hazard ratio was around 0.7. So here you had, again, by any parameter of efficacy, advantage for nivolumab versus ipilimumab. And if you look at the toxicity, again, you decide what parameter you want to measure. Treatment-related high-grade toxicity was clearly favoring nivolumab versus ipilimumab. It was something like 10% versus 42%. Proportion of patients who stopped because of high-grade toxicity, we're looking at 4% versus 28 or 30%. So clear advantage in terms of side effects for the nivolumab. And again, if you do the cross-study comparison, which is not necessarily valid, but if you do a back-of-the-napkin calculation, if you had only 8% of all patients stop because of toxicity in Nivo, compare that to 26% in the COMBAD arm, one might argue nivolumab is a pretty well-tolerated regimen as adjuvant treatment for a year.
So I only have about 218 questions after hearing all that, so let me get started. Incredible. Like I said, lots going on. Okay, so first of all, before we start talking about like what this all means, what did we know prior to this about adjuvant treatment with PD-1 inhibitors?
Well, there have been or has been a single pilot study, which interestingly I was the PI of, where we treated patients, a small number, 33 patients with nivolumab alone in a pilot adjuvant trial. And to do this, we chose the worst actors. We chose stage 3C and 4 resected melanoma patients. Of those 33 patients that we treated, We felt it was fairly well tolerated. Only something like 3 of them had to go off because of side effects. And of those 33, we have now 5 years plus of follow-up. There have only been 6 deaths and 11 relapses over time in that cohort of patients. And that relapse rate has plateaued. I don't think there's been a patient that's relapsed in over a year on that trial, suggesting that there's a plateau on the relapse curve. So again, 2/3 of the patients continuously without relapse over 5 years. You figure most of those patients are probably going to be cured of melanoma. And in that trial, 31 of 33 had resected stage 4 disease. So that's a pretty favorable scenario.
Wow, resected stage 4?
These are almost all resected stage 4s. We had 10 patients with resected brain mets, Neil.
Wow.
And of those 10, 9 are currently alive and free of disease and have never relapsed.
But on the other hand, no prior randomized data of anti-PD-1 adjuvant?
There had been no adjuvant experience with PD-1 antibodies in any way, shape, or form prior to that study.
So what an amazing study. So, but again, before we get back to that, again, adjuvant randomized targeted therapy trials prior to these ones you just mentioned.
There had been none. Not only had there been no randomized adjuvant targeted trials, there had been no pilot trials of adjuvant targeted therapy. All adjuvant experience was in the metastatic mode.
So anyhow, first of all, congratulations. Wow, this is incredible. These data came in fantastic. But now let's talk about what it means. Let's talk about the targeted therapy first. What fraction of these patients got anti-BRAF therapy on relapse in the control arms?
That is a very interesting question. So we don't have all the full data on this, although the majority of patients who relapsed, of course, would then have gotten further therapy. The majority of them were not re-resected, rendered free of disease. I think 10% of them who relapsed could again be rendered free of disease. And that was evenly balanced, I think, between the arms. And in those groups, actually the majority or a significant minority got immunotherapy, not targeted therapy. Although obviously the people who had been in the targeted therapy arm of COMBI-AD who relapsed, generally the investigators were going to give them immunotherapy because they would then break the code because it impacts the treatment. In the placebo arm, I think a significant group also got immunotherapy. They did not necessarily get targeted therapy. So the interesting question, which you're getting at, is could you simply wait and treat till later to see how those patients do? You can only do that if you guarantee that there's an absolute crossover in the placebo arm. Since that could not be guaranteed and was not part of the trial, you're not, Neil, going to be able to answer the question of targeted therapy now or later. Amongst my colleagues, most feel that once you metastasize, you should be giving immunotherapy frontline.
Sure, but let me ask you another question. I think you mentioned it was international. And most of the patients, were they in environments where they could get, you know, further combination targeted therapy, theoretically, or were they, you know, because there's countries where you can't access it?
Well, it's an interesting point. That trial started something like 4 years ago. So in not all countries in the EMEA, Canada and Australia, were the combination, was dabrafenib trametinib approved. So you're right, there was no guarantee that they'd be able to get it, which probably in part accounts for the fact that in the placebo arm, only a small number actually got targeted therapy.
Did you know that in breast cancer, I don't know how many years ago, there was the Scottish trial that randomized between adjuvant tamoxifen and tamoxifen on relapse?
I didn't know that one.
And guess what? They saw the exact same risk reduction adjuvant.
That's interesting. You know, there is a trial that's ongoing in stage 3 resected melanoma in Europe. It's an EORTC trial where patients are randomly allocated to get the PD-1 antibody pembrolizumab for a year or placebo who have resected stage 3 disease. And they're guaranteed if they were in the arm that got the placebo, they could cross over on relapse. So that is Lex Eggermont's trial. And that will, we hope, answer the question of whether you should get it now or whether you should get it later. I would be willing to venture a bet that you're better off getting it earlier as adjuvant therapy than later as metastatic therapy.
Yeah, I mean, the tamoxifen trial showed there was a survival benefit to getting it as adjuvant therapy. So, but there rarely that you see that. But look, you have this kind of hazard rate. I think nobody's going to quibble with the fact that it's a great risk-benefit move, so to speak. But Certainly, it sounds like going through a year of nivolumab is going to be a lot better than going through adjuvant ipi. So do you think that it'd be possible to actually access that right now outside a trial setting?
Nivolumab in most places in the U.S. is available through the patient access program. In other words, if you apply to insurance and you have resected stage 3 or 4 melanoma and you apply for nivolumab and you get turned down, you'll get it for free through the patient assistance program, which I think is a very wise move.
Yeah, that's awesome.
There will be no expanded access trial as there was for ipilimumab previously. And the reason why is I think that the FDA today moves so quickly that given the quality of those data, I would venture a guess that both Dabtrem and Nivolumab will be approved early in 2018. So there's no reason to do an expanded access trial. They just make it available.
Right. Yeah, that's great. So you're the first melanoma investigator I've talked to about all this. I'm just kind of trying to process it. I can't wait to hear what everybody else says. But it sounds like it's going to be kind of an interesting question about what you do about BRAF patients. Are you going to give them both?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think that most insurance companies would pay for both as adjuvant therapy. The question is, does someone need to do a trial of triple therapy versus double therapy? That's a different scenario. That may be an upcoming trial.
But meanwhile, what, you have to choose?
I would say if you're a BRAF mutated patient, you're going to have a couple of good choices. Remember, in the Dabtrem trial, it was stage 3A, 3B, 3C. And you had to have more than a millimeter of tumor in your node if you were 3A, meaning a slightly higher risk group. With the Nivo-Ipi trial, there were no 3As. It was only 3B, 3C, and 4. So again, different groups. And to decide which therapy looked more promising, you'd have to do what I described at ESMO as a not very kosher comparison. You'd have to break out the 3Bs and 3Cs from the COMBI-AD trial, break out the 3B, 3C from the 238 trial, and try to compare the Nivo versus the Dabtrem group. At the end of the day, I would predict that they'll look very similar, and I think either treatment for a BRAF mutated patient would be quite favorable.
So, I mean, I would assume that those staging things are kind of just artificial. You know, you really think it wouldn't work and a different slightly. It's not, I mean, you make the decision you want to give adjuvant therapy, you're really going to look in terms of what subset it is?
Well, that's a good point, Neil. But if you look at the ipilimumab trial, which was the EORTC, I think it was 18071 trial, whose updated survival data were published in New England Journal, the 3A patients didn't get all that much benefit. It was all in the 3Bs and the 3Cs. So you wonder, does immunotherapy have a differential effect depending on your burden of disease? I'm hard-pressed to believe that's true with nivolumab, but...
How about just random chance in a trial?
Hard to believe with several hundred patients who had stage 3A disease in that trial, it was random chance. I would predict that the FDA will be asked to approve nivolumab as adjuvant therapy for stage 3 and 4, and they will not differentiate. And they will think, just like you did, that 3A, 3B, 3C, it's just a continuum. Why would we differentiate?
And how about the anti-BRAF?
That'll get approved for all stage 3. I would assume that's where the registration would be applied for, although I don't know. So I think you'll have, for any stage 3 patient who is BRAF mutated, you'll have some very good options. I would say it's going to really depend on what part of the country you're in and whether you're in an academic or an office setting, whether you get Dabtrem or whether you get nivolumab. I think either one sounds like a great option. With longer follow-up, if the survival curves for nivolumab stay flat, but the survival curves for Dabtrem come down, that may influence people, but we won't know that for years. And I suspect that you'll do well either way with either treatment. Obviously, if you're BRAF wild type, you're going to get nivolumab. Nobody's going to give ipi up front as adjuvant therapy.
Sure.
However, a lot of patients who get nivolumab adjuvant therapy will relapse with local, regional, or isolated unimetastatic disease, a single met, and get re-resected. And then what do you do? That's where maybe if you're wild type, you'll get ipi, or if you're mutated, you'll get Dabtrem.
You mean you convert from a non-mutated to mutated?
No. If you were a mutated patient and got Nivo adjuvant therapy and relapsed loco-regionally, Neil, then you'll probably get Dabtrem, and it'll go the other way. If you got Dabtrem in the beginning and then you relapsed and then you were rendered free of disease, you get Nivo adjuvant therapy. The big question, though, is what do you do when you relapse with metastatic disease? This is what everybody wants to know. So?
You mean after adjuvant therapy?
Yeah, what if you relapse with unresectable disease after adjuvant therapy and it's only been a few months?
Okay.
And you had Nevo. What do you do then?
You tell me.
What if it was 3 years ago? So what I think will happen is, I think first we have to biopsy everybody. Everybody who relapses after adjuvant therapy, and you have to start characterizing the tumors, and we have to get better information on predictive markers pre-treatment and then markers at the time of relapse for what's going on. And we need to understand the mechanism of resistance, say, to Nevo or Dab-Trem in the relapsing tumors. That's number one. Number two, in the real world, if you relapsed less than 6 months after one of those treatments, you're not going to get treated with the same drugs again. People will switch to something else. If you relapsed more than 6 months from prior nivolumab, I think you're fair game to get Pembro plus epacadostat, or Nevo alone, or Pembro plus something else, or Ipi-Nevo as your next therapy. If you were BRAF mutated, it wouldn't be unreasonable, say, to give Dab plus Trem, or Dab-Trem plus an immunotherapy added together.
So I'm going to ask you about epacadostat in a second, but I still want to go back to this BRAF adjuvant situation. And first of all, say that I'm going to say this is unprecedented in the history of oncology. The current situation that you just described, you have two very effective adjuvant therapies, and you theoretically could give either one to the same patient. You tell me that I don't ever recall that happening before, but anyhow, it's very, very provocative. I have no idea how people are going to sort this thing out. It's very kind of fresh, but let me just ask you a question. Can you describe a clinical situation where you have an adjuvant situation of a high risk of relapse? And then tell me, you know, describe it in terms of number of nodes, high risk of relapse, and how you think that risk would change if you gave, for example, adjuvant Nevo. Can you describe a case that would, say, have a 50% chance of relapse, and then how you think it would be modified by giving Nevo?
Well, take any patient who has a stage 3C resected situation where you have multiple positive lymph nodes with macroscopic disease where you can palpate it, or stage 3D disease, which is in the new staging category, where you might have matted lymph nodes, multiple palpable nodes, extracapsular extension, with a thick primary that was ulcerated. You know those patients with no adjuvant treatment. You can virtually guarantee they're going to relapse.
So you think 90%?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's say someone had, for example, I saw a lady yesterday who had 25 of 27 positive lymph nodes with actually not even that thick a primary. I mean, that's a disastrous situation.
She had BRAF positive?
She was BRAF negative. So she's in her 60s, 25 of 27 positive lymph nodes.
Okay, so what's her 5-year risk of relapse?
The risk of relapse in her is virtually 100%.
Okay, and how do you think that'd be modified by giving adjuvant Nevo?
I think that based on the data we know, you're probably going to drop it by a significant margin. It may well be as much as a third or 35%, which was the hazard ratio, which is explained by the hazard ratio of 0.65.
So she would go from roughly almost 100% chance of relapse to 65% chance?
Correct.
Okay.
Which is a significant increment. You're not going to guarantee curing
Absolutely.
Her, but that's benefit.
So my question is, if she were BRAF positive, and at the end of that year of Nevo, or even during the Nevo, you gave her the Dab-Trem regimen, do you think it would come down further?
I would say there's a, now nobody knows the answer. So we're doing hand waving. I'm literally waving my hands. I would say that in a patient like that, it is entirely possible if you gave Dab-Trem plus Nevo or Dab-Trem plus Pembro, you could have a further decrement in relapse or an increment in relapse-free survival. And that is a trial that is begging to be done if the current metastatic trial of like Vem-Cobi-Atezo or Dab-Trem-Pembro, you know, there are two trials, shows that giving triple therapy is better than just giving either the immunotherapy or the targeted therapy alone. Then you're going to see a complicated, expensive adjuvant trial where you'll look at triple therapy versus either Dab-Trem or PD-1 antibody alone or PD-L1 antibody alone. That's a big trial.
Just out of curiosity, a highly educated patient comes to you and says, I'll pay for it. Will you give it to me?
You mean, let's say, Dabtrem plus Nevo or Dabtrem plus Pembro?
Yes.
If they had a high enough risk and I could get it, I guess I would try it. One might argue I have no data to justify that regimen because it has not been shown to be more advantageous in the metastatic mode than just giving targeted or immunotherapy alone. And you could also argue I'm spending an awful lot of society's money on something that's unproven. I guess my answer is I'd be tempted. I might well do it. I'm not sure exactly. It would depend on the individual scenario.
I think it's a lot different. I mean, you describe a situation where you think there's a 100% chance to relapse. That's really metastatic disease.
Absolutely correct.
I think if you had a situation where you had maybe a 50% chance to relapse and you were bringing it down to 30 or whatever, then it might be a little trickier. You don't know. You could be losing benefit. You never know. There might be some kind of weird interaction. I mean, anyway, I just think...
That's, Neil, why I would tailor it to the individual patient. My patient with 25 of 27 positive nodes, you're absolutely right. That's effectively stage 4 disease. You know and I know that she's got disease lurking everywhere, and it's just a matter of time before she relapses if she doesn't get treated. She's going to start treatment tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But would I consider a triple regimen for someone like that? Yeah, I would.
It's really interesting about what you're saying, a metastatic disease combining checkpoint inhibitors and anti-BRAF therapy. And again, you get into this issue of, well, suppose you get it later, but what is the design of those studies and any thoughts about what you think you're going to see? I guess you would expect to at least see higher response rates initially, huh?
Well, there have been a couple of trials that are small pilot phase 1/2 trials that have been done. There's a vemurafenib, cobimetinib, atezolizumab trial. Atezo is a PD-L1 antibody.
Approved in bladder and lung.
Yeah, it's approved in bladder and other cancers, but it's not approved in melanoma. And then there's a KEYNOTE-022 trial that Tony Ribas presented, and I think that's Dabtrem pembrolizumab. And we're looking at 80% plus response rates and waterfall plots where virtually everything goes down below the origin. On the other hand, you could argue with the proper selection with 20 or 30 patients, you could see the same thing just with Dabtrem or Vemcobi. So it's hard to know.
Any safety signal issues?
Actually not.
I've heard some bad things about toxicity, but not here with BRAF.
No, I mean, what you look at is you're probably seeing additive or even less than additive toxicity when you add the PD-1 antibody to the BRAF-MEK combination. So they appear to be well tolerated. They're both involved, I gather, in large randomized trials. And we're not going to know probably for another year whether it's better to give what, as you can figure, is going to be a pretty darn expensive regimen of 3 drugs than either 2 drugs or, say, PD-1 antibody alone. It's hard to know.
What a fascinating situation. I wonder what could be done to help patients understand this. But anyhow, getting back to this adjuvant situation for BRAF, one of the things that probably people think about, and I want to ask you about this anyhow, because we've talked about this before, is what we know about long-term remission /? Cures that you see with anti-BRAF therapy and with checkpoint inhibitors. In the past, there's been this feeling that it's not necessarily likely, but it's more likely with immunotherapy. And then I started to hear from people, including you, that, well, sometimes you see really prolonged responses, maybe even cures with targeted therapy. And I think that could influence how people see it in the adjuvant setting, although, yeah, it's different. But where are we today in terms of understanding, are we curing any of these patients?
Well, if you look at the long-term data, where you're looking at 3, 4, 5-year survival from the original Dabtrem trial, and that trial originally was published almost 5 years ago. So now you have 5-year data. You probably have a plateau of survival in the 20 to 30% range, which, again, you don't have a good comparator for, say, ipi-nivo, because you don't have 5-year survival from ipi-nivo. But the 3-year survival from ipi-nivo would suggest that you're going to be higher. You're going to be closer to 50%. At about 3 years, and you may even, it's actually above 50% for ipi-nivo at 3 years. So I would have to believe at the end of the day, if you look at ipi-nivo 5-year survival, it's going to be better than getting upfront targeted therapy. Do you see some patients who are on that plateau of survival? Absolutely, with dab-trem. Is it going to be as high as pembro or nivo alone or ipi-nivo? That's not clear. And I would say ipi-nivo is probably going to end up plateauing at a higher level, and you'll have more patients that are cured. I'll give you again an example. The last patient that I saw yesterday was a lady who traveled from another state to see me just for the opinion of whether she should stop treatment with nivolumab, having been on ipi-nivo a year and three quarters ago, had some significant side effects with hypophysitis, got her fourth cycle of ipi-nivo, and then went on maintenance, and she's been on maintenance for a year and a half. And her question was, well, I'm told I should continue nivolumab forever. Can I stop? And I said, well, your PET CT and CT scans show that you have no evidence of disease and you've been that way for months. I personally would stop. I think you have a very good shot at being cured. Because again, if you look at the patients in complete remission who either got ipi-nivo or pembro alone, those patients, 90% of them over time are going to stay in remission. And we don't have a lot of follow-up, but there'll be a manuscript coming out from Caroline Robert soon in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. She's already presented these data at ASCO and ESMO, suggesting that with a modest amount of follow-up, once you stop treatment, at least a year later, 90%+ of the CRs stay in remission. So I told this lady to stop. I don't think you need to get treated forever. At least with immunotherapy, I think you can quit after a year, maybe a year and a half.
I want to ask you about ipi-nivo in a second. You say the word hypophysitis.
Hypophysitis.
Right? Yeah, so when you say the word hypophysitis, of course, I've always got to ask you because I'm always so fascinated by that. I'm just kind of curious, how did she present clinically?
Oh, boy. Well, she got pretty sick. She was incredibly fatigued, had a sodium of 128, I believe got admitted to the hospital, was dehydrated, just felt like hell. And there was a little delay in recognizing what this was.
Did she have a headache?
No, actually, she didn't really have a headache.
Because you told me before some of these people have headaches, right?
Every once in a while, patients will have the worst headache of their life. And your assumption is, oh my God, they've developed a giant brain met and they just hemorrhaged. And you get an MRI scan of the brain and it says no evidence of disease, but the pituitary is slightly enlarged and inhomogeneous. And then you realize, aha, it's hypophysitis.
So how long did it take them to figure it out? And did she have it on imaging?
She did not have it on imaging, and I don't think she had an MRI scan of the brain because she had no headache symptoms. She had CTs, of course, of her chest, abdomen, pelvis. It actually took several weeks to figure this out.
Wow.
Because the treating oncologist in the community wasn't that experienced. It may have been his or her first time using the two drugs together. In an experienced center like where I work or any one of many academic centers, whenever you see a sodium of 118, your first thought is, oh my God, it's essentially an Addisonian situation where you have either hypoadrenalism or hypopituitarism. And, you know, we will check ACTH, cortisol, T4, TSH, et cetera, just at the drop of a hat. So we make that diagnosis very quickly. Obviously, without experience, it's not your first intuitive thought.
So, you know, wow, it's a real challenge to be an oncologist. It's a shame that they didn't pick that up earlier, although we just did a multi-tumor thing last week, and you know, we probably went through 20 newly approved drugs. I mean, completely new things coming into practice. It's like a lot to keep up, but wow, what a shame. And yeah, at least they finally figured it out.
Yeah, it was finally figured out. She went on replacement, and actually, the oncologist is pretty gutsy. He gave her her fourth go-round of ipi-nivo while she was on thyroid replacement and corticosteroids. And got away with it. She did fine. And then she's been on nivo maintenance and feels okay, except for a little bit of fatigue. And she made this interesting observation. She said, you know, when I went on nivolumab, my blood pressure went up.
Hmm.
And I said, interesting. I've never heard of that. And I said, tell me what other medicines you take. And it turns out she takes fludrocortisone, which is probably why her blood pressure went up a little bit, because that's the mineralocorticoid piece of the steroids that sometimes when you get hypophysitis, you lack. Most of the time, we put people on hydrocortisone and that's that. We don't usually have to put them on hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone or Florinef because there's enough mineralocorticoid activity of the hydrocortisone to accommodate for what they've lost by having the low pituitary output of the ACTH. But in her case, she needed it, and I think that probably pushed her blood pressure up a bit. So I advised her to play around with her scheduling and maybe take it every other, every third day, not every day.
Wow, amazing.
An interesting case.
Where do things stand right now in terms of first-line therapy of metastatic disease? And I'll start out with a BRAF wild-type situation and, you know, the PD-1 versus combo ipi/nivo.
Well, again, as always, a controversy, and Jed Walchak recently came out with a first author New England Journal article. Interestingly, it wasn't presented at ESMO, but it just came out in the New England Journal at the same time as all the other adjuvant stuff. So once again, these last few months, it's the New England Journal of Melanoma, which is good. So there's clearly at 3 years both a progression-free and an overall survival advantage. It's at least 5 or 6 percentage points. It looks as if the survival at 3 years in ipi/nivo is beginning to plateau. It's above 50%. So the median survival is going to be well beyond 3 years with ipi/nivo. I predict it's beyond 40 months. And that beats the heck out of anything that we have seen with any other melanoma therapy in a large, well-conducted study. So when you talk to patients and they say, "Doc, what treatment will give me the longest survival and the greatest chance of being alive at 3 years, 4 years, 5 years?" It's got to be ipi/nivo. And I can't argue with that. On the other hand, I can't argue with a 55 to 60% rate of grade 3-4 toxicity. And trust me, I've seen enough patients on the combo to know that the toxicity is pretty impressive. But in a young person, someone who can take it, someone who wants to take it, I think that's the way to go. And what we're doing now is playing around with the dose and scheduling to see if you can drop the toxicity maybe to the 30% range to make it more palatable, maintain the benefit, and now adding new drugs to the flip dose ipi/nivo. So we have this month starting a HDAC inhibitor plus ipi plus nivo trial where we flip the ipi/nivo doses. It'll take a bit of experience to see whether that looks as good as ipi at 3, nivo at 1 as the induction, which is where you run into all the side effects.
Getting back though to the decision between ipi/nivo and single agent nivo or PD-1, do you look at all or think about PD-1 levels or anything else in terms of predictors?
Interestingly, in that trial in the New England Journal, virtually all the benefit of ipi/nivo versus nivo alone came in the PD-L1 negative population. The PD-L1 positive population, however you cut it, there didn't appear to be much of a difference in the progression-free and overall survival between the combo and nivo alone. So after seeing the data, I said, boy, I'm going to have to start spending more time getting PD-L1 staining on the pretreatment tumors. Interestingly, not all of my colleagues agree with that thought. I would say more of them disagree. They'll just say, nah, I'm not going to use PD-L1 staining. I don't think it gives enough information. I've always been the guy who is cynical about PD-L1 staining as a predictive marker. If you actually do a formal evaluation on a receiver operating curve of the performance of PD-L1 staining, the area under the curve is like 0.65, which basically is utterly mediocre. If I tried to sell you a predictive test today with that area under the curve on the ROC curve, you would laugh at me. However, in this scenario, it may be useful.
So bottom line is, for practical purposes, are you getting the assay or not?
I am getting the assay if I know I need to make the decision between ipi/nivo and nivo or pembro alone, or usually it's not pembro alone, it's usually a trial of pembro or nivo plus some other drug. In that scenario, I'll get the staining done and I factor that into the equation.
And without, you know, if you kind of put aside whether or not you can look at the PD-1 level globally in your own kind of gut way, interpreting clinical research, et cetera, in your mind, how much is it adding to add the ipi? So, for example, what do you think the relative, I'm not asking you to quote from the trial, but just what you think, how much more do you think it lowers the risk, the relative risk, by adding in the ipi?
I think it gives you about a 5% absolute benefit in survival. And again, if you're 85, you may not want that 5%.
How about hazard rate, though?
The toxicity. The hazard ratio, again, it's difficult to look at the hazard ratio because that trial, the 067 CheckMate trial, was powered to compare either ipi/nivo or nivo versus ipi as a control. It was never truly powered with appropriate assumptions of having a narrow difference to see a real hazard ratio between them. But you can do anything you want statistically. I think the hazard ratio was in the mid 0.8 range.
So, I mean, yeah, that's why I said I'm not asking you to interpret the trial or any trial, but just in your own gut, having siphoned through all these data, do you think that, okay, so you have a response rate, a benefit just by using PD-1, do you think that adding Ipi adds another 50% to that or much less?
Oh, no, it adds much less. The absolute benefit is not more than 5% in my view.
Because that was my take.
The hazard ratio is probably in the mid 0.8 range. So figure it's about 0.82, 0.85. That's a 15% relative change, a 5% absolute change. Some patients may not want to deal with that. So it's really, this is where you need to get the patient involved in the decision-making. This is not such an easy decision.
It also happens a lot in oncology, though, you know, this balancing things off, et cetera. Let me just ask you a couple other sort of follow-up questions, again, to all these things we've been talking about. First of all, in terms of adding things in to immunotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors, first of all, you mentioned HDAC inhibitors. I'm not sure I've heard a whole lot about HDAC inhibitors in melanoma. It kind of doesn't seem to catch on anywhere that much, but what's the thinking there?
Well, HDAC inhibitors are actually drugs that are approved in some of the hematologic malignancies.
Right.
So HDAC inhibitors are epigenetic agents, which, as you can tell by the name, they impact on the acetylation of histones, which are an integral part of the DNA, and they do a lot of gene expression control. It's just part of our normal cell metabolic regulation apparatus. So it turns out that
Robidepsin and T-cell lymphoma, for example.
Yeah, so yes, exactly. So it's approved in some narrow indications in the heme malignancies because there it has a direct anti-tumor effect. In a histology like lung cancer or melanoma, HDAC inhibitors alone probably don't do very much. What they do accomplish, though, is they have immunologic boosting effects, and that's only been found over the last couple of years. So they would be perfectly matched to add to a drug like Ipi and Nivo because they downmodulate T regulatory cells, downmodulate myeloid-derived suppressor cells, which are the bad guys, and that may help unleash more of an immune response when you add either Nivo or Pembro or Ipi plus Nivo. And they're already in combo trials.
Yeah, I think I've heard that from Paul Richardson about myelomas now that I'm thinking about it. What about the other agent? And I've been hearing more about this. It sounds kind of promising, or this kind of strategy, epacadostat.
Epacadostat is an IDO inhibitor, and IDO is a substance made by tumors and by antigen-presenting cells. That's yet another immune suppressive influence. It's not like a checkpoint. It's not a molecule on the T cells. It's a soluble material or material that's at the membrane of the cell that acts to suppress immunity. It sucks up certain amino acids like tryptophan, and if the T cells don't have any tryptophan, they are not happy. If you have tryptophan or other essential amino acids, the T cells work better. So it's an indirect way of boosting immunity. And if you use an IDO inhibitor alone in melanoma, it doesn't do anything. It has almost no anti-tumor activity, but it looks very promising if you add it to PD-1 blockade. Because in a mouse, it works great to boost the effects of the PD-1 blockade. And in the initial trials in people, of which there have been two or three, there's been epacadostat plus Nivo, epacadostat Pembro. You get a very high response rate in the 50%+ range. And again, you expect maybe 40% frontline response rate with Nivo or Pembro alone. But most importantly, the progression-free survival looks like it's about a year. And PFS is your endpoint because with PD-1 antibody alone in most trials, progression-free survival is like 6-7 months. If you go up to 12 months, that's probably a real change. And if you do enough patients in a phase 2 study, figure, 50, 60, 70, 80 patients, and you see a PFS across the board of 12 months, I would say that's very encouraging. And I'd certainly bet that in a randomized trial, Pembro epacadostat would be better by virtue of better PFS than Pembro alone. And we'll find that out early in 2018. I think there's this randomized trial ongoing, and it should have enough time to mature to give us those data.
This is an oral agent?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to take.
No tolerability issues?
Minimal toxicity changes versus Pembro alone or Nivo alone. I say it looks like a very promising idea. And now we're looking at Ipi-Nivo epacadostat. So we're doing the double combo. Now we're looking at the triple combination. That'll be very interesting. I like that idea.
Getting back to targeted therapy, we were talking about the DAB-TREM combination. Of course, you have vemurafenib, COBI, and there's another one, encorafenib, binimetinib. Is that approved yet or?
Not approved yet. That probably will get approved. It's not a drug that I've spent much time working with, but you know, technically the data look just as good with all three BRAF-MEK combinations. There's no reason why, in terms of efficacy and toxicity, it wouldn't get approved. I assume that's going to happen.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you think that these three combinations, in your mind, is there any way to separate out either the efficacy or toxicity ratios?
At the end of the day, I assume the efficacy will be identical. I think the only difference will be the toxicity profile. So if you start with DAB-TREM and somebody has horrendous fatigue and fevers, you can switch them to VEM-COBI, and then you'll be dealing with a different set of issues. It might be dermatologic or maybe nausea. And if that didn't work, you could switch to a third potential combination. But again, it's going to be based on the toxicity profile. I'm hard-pressed to believe that any of those drugs, any of those combinations will be any different in terms of efficacy. Median survival is all going to be about 25 months. And that's, to me, that's the key indicator. And the plateau is going to be pretty far down below 30% at 5 years for all of them.
It's interesting. We're finding now in non-small cell lung cancer for the BRAF patients, they're using DAB-TREM first line, non-small cell lung cancer.
I would predict it would work very well, whether you will see the same duration of response and the plateau with non-small cell compared to melanoma, not clear. I don't think BRAF is as important a driver in non-small cell lung cancer as it is in melanoma.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. The waterfall plot looks good, but I don't think they see that kind of duration. And then, of course, colon is a complete mess because that doesn't work at all. They're given like chemo, VEMU, and EGFR antibody, seeing some response. But it's interesting how in the different tumors, BRAF is kind of plays out a little bit differently. Any idea why?
BRAF plays a very important role in driving melanoma. The MAP kinase pathway is key. In colon cancer, for example, EGFR is a much more important part of the pathway, so it allows a bypass pathway to arise much more readily in those cells compared to, say, in melanoma, where resistance to BRAF MEK inhibition is almost all through MAP kinase pathway reinvigoration, so to speak. It's not exactly that way in colon cancer. EGFR plays a more important role.
So I want to get to your cases in a minute, but a couple other things I just want to throw out to you. So here's one, just kind of curious. Any thoughts about? So oral from ASCO. Association of the diversity and composition of the gut microbiome with responses and survival in metastatic melanoma patients on anti-PD-1 therapy.
This, I believe, was Jen Wargo's work. These are very important data in Science magazine. Outstanding work, and the Science article basically recaps what she presented at ASCO. And there will be a companion article from Laurence Zitvogel, who's from the Gustave Roussy in Paris. And both of them were similar analyses, although there were some major differences in the outcomes and in the conclusions. But the bottom line is there are certain bacterial species associated with resistance and with efficacy of PD-1 blockade. There's no question about it. And bizarrely enough, they appear to be mostly anaerobic. Clostridiales and Bacteroidiales are the species that are associated with either doing well or not doing well. And why anaerobes? Obviously, anaerobes have the ability to metabolize things that probably get into the bloodstream that can be immunosuppressive or immunoboosting. And 5 years ago, no one would have thought this was the case. But now we're looking at hundreds of patients worth of data, and it's obviously real. And in the Zitvogel data, I think they came up with a specific bacterial species. It was a group of species with the Wargo article that was the one that was discussed at ASCO. So these are important data. And guess what's going to happen? This will lead to a trial. What's the trial? You'll take the bacteria that were associated with a good outcome with PD-1 blockade, and you'll attempt to isolate some small number of bacteria. You'll lyophilize them, put them in a pill, and they'll just be administered as a pill after maybe giving antibiotics to clear out a lot of the gut flora to make space microbiologically. Then you'll try to reconstitute the gut flora in patients who then get PD-1 blockade and compare that to PD-1 blockade where you take an irrelevant bacteria or a placebo of some sort.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's going on? Is it sort of a like pharmacologic issue that it's in some way interfering with the checkpoint inhibitor molecule pharmacologically, or is it biologic? What's happening?
No, I think it's indirect, and I think that the bacterial species cause secretion into the bloodstream of immunosuppressive influences that boost the activity of things like T regulatory cells. And I think in both of those articles and Jen Wargo's presentation at ASCO implied that there were clear effects on the immune system of the presence of some bacterial species versus others. The problem I have is to reconstitute human microbiome is not so easy. For example, if I gave you big-time antibiotics intravenously for a week, you'd wipe out 99.9% of your bacteria. But if I stopped a couple of weeks later, you would just reconstitute and you'd be back to where you were when you started. So changing the microbiome in humans is not so easy. The model systems are mice, and in a germ-free mouse, it's a little different than if it's you or me. But people will now put a lot of effort into understanding how to reconstitute the microbiome, and the full weight and force of the biotech and pharmaceutical industries will be applied to this. And I predict we can figure this one out in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, actually, Alan Vinook of GI fame or interest that brought this up to me recently, and he was also talking about the difference between the bacteria and the right side of the, you know, they have this big thing, right versus left colon cancer, and that the bacteria are different there. When they actually do this work, where do they get the samples from?
The work in humans is mostly they grab it through a colonoscopy. Most of the work we do is from stool samples, though. I mean, we, for example, when Jen Wargo did her study, she collected poop, pre-treatment, on-treatment, blood, tumor, and tried to connect them, as did Laurence Vogel. So you wouldn't believe, so it's actually hilarious, Neil. Every patient we see who goes on immunotherapy, we hand them a little box and say, would you mind donating a sample of poop for our study? And they look at you like you're insane. And they said, now I know you find this hard to believe, but it's amazing how what's in your poop may impact on how your body handles this treatment. And I say, look at it this way. It's a renewable resource. There's plenty of it. It shouldn't be a problem. It's not painful to donate it. It's a little messy, but you know, here's how you do it. And we give them the little kit. And then it gets frozen away, and you analyze the DNA of the bacteria.
Well, that's, I mean, I like it because it's different. It's really fascinating. I've heard little things about this from people interested in immunotherapy in different, I can't even remember whether it was lung or heme or whatever, but this idea of the connection between the microbiome and checkpoint inhibitors, has that only been looked at in melanoma or with other cancers?
No, people are looking at it in other cancers, bladder, lung cancer. There's no question it's probably real. 5 or 6 years ago, I would have thought it was a bunch of crap, no pun intended. But today, it is unequivocal. If you look at work by Tom Gajewski, by Laurence Sidvogel, by Jen Wargo, I mean, those are the three major investigators in the melanoma-related field. There's no question it's real. And actually, Sidvogel had an interesting abstract that was presented by one of her kidney colleagues. It suggested that people who got antibiotics while they were getting PD-1 blockade didn't do as well as those who got no antibiotics, which is almost hard to believe.
Wow.
But I mean, she had data from a couple of hundred patients. It looked real. So it's a little scary. It suggests the type of antibiotics you take may impact on how well you do. So this is an up-and-coming field.
Pretty naive about this stuff, but like when you take, I don't know, maybe patients take it too. There are these things you buy in the whatever pharmacy, some of them refrigerated.
Yes.
What do you call it? Macrobiotics? What does that do to the biome?
To experts in the field, and remember, I'm not a microbiologist. I am not an infectious disease specialist, but if you speak to people at my institution like Marty Blazer, who is a world-class expert on the human microbiome and an infectious disease doc who's written lay books on the subject, Marty Blazer would tell you that taking probiotics will have minimal impact on your microbiome because you have this homeostatic reset and you'll take the pills and then a couple of weeks later, you'll just be back where you started. So he doesn't think that that would work unless somehow you blasted the body with big time antibiotics and sort of reset the playing field for the microbiome and then gave the bacteria. So this is going to be the subject of some serious research over the next 5 years.
So here's another one I want to ask you about. I know nothing about it, but I've always got my eye open for antibody-drug conjugates. And I see there was presented at ASCO glembatumumab vedotin. Anything there?
Yeah, there were some interesting data with that drug alone and that drug with CD27. Some interesting responses have been seen in patients with brain mets, potentially patients with ocular melanoma. We have seen anecdotal responses, small numbers, but real responses in patients who failed other therapy. So there's something interesting going on there, and that is worth pursuing. I don't know how far that's going to go, but that's pretty much all that you can say. It looks quite interesting. Other interesting stuff from the ASCO meeting that were also presented at ESMO a month ago or so in Madrid were, actually now it's almost 2 months ago, were the LAG-3 plus nivolumab trial that was presented at both meetings by Paolo Acerto. And there, I mean, that's one of the more interesting combinations where you had some responses in patients who were either PD-1 relapsed or PD-1 refractory. So again, there are many trials in either PD-1 refractory patients who never responded to PD-1 or those who were stable for a while or responded and then relapsed. And this looks like one of the more promising ones. So this will certainly be pursued. There were responses mostly in those who were stable to PD-1 and then progressed and then got PD-1 plus LAG-3 or Nivo plus LAG-3. It looks very interesting. There are a couple of LAG-3 antibodies out there, so you're going to hear a lot more about that.
I remember hearing about LAG-3, and is it TIM-3? Are these other checkpoints?
Neil, there are at least 8 or 9, maybe 10 different checkpoints on T cells, all of which are receptors for various ligands. And the so-called exhausted T cells tend to be PD-1 positive, LAG-3 positive, TIM-3 positive. So if you are resistant to PD-1 blockade, it may be because you have too high a level of the other breaks, the other checkpoints. And if you begin to combine the blocking of those checkpoints, you may get higher response rates. So that will be strongly pursued by a number of groups and a number of companies.
So let's try to get to a couple of your cases. We haven't talked about basal cell for a while. So want to tell me about your 72-year-old man?
Yeah, I mean, I occasionally will treat patients with basal cell. So this was a guy treated some time ago who was treated with the hedgehog inhibitor vismatogib. And the problem is we see a lot of patients who have facial basal cells that often are ignored, and they end up needing to have disfiguring plastic surgery. They get radiation, it returns, and then you have to operate in a radiated field. So the nice thing about that and the newer hedgehog inhibitors is you can often do neoadjuvant therapy with the hedgehog inhibitors, shrink the tumor, and have a much better therapy. So I think that this was the classic case, but this was a guy who is an alcoholic. He was not taking care of himself. He let this thing get very large. He had a very good partial shrinkage of his tumor, but had the typical side effects, the asthenia, the poor appetite, fatigue, muscle aches, elected to go off, and then he was able to have a decent surgery. So I think this is a typical story. And both with the hedgehog inhibitors and basal cell, this will be a common phenomenon. As you also have heard, there's a PD-1 inhibitor that has activity in squamous cancer. Actually, several of the PD-1 antibodies do, with 50% response rate in locally advanced or metastatic squamous cancer of the skin. So you'll see the same thing. Someone with a big, ugly squamous cancer that recurs on the face will get treated with PD-1 blockade and then as a neoadjuvant treatment, and then you'll operate on them. And I think it'll be better. It's an expensive way to deal with tumors, many of which are ignored, but I think that the patients will clearly benefit and you'll have a much easier surgery. You won't have these unbelievable surgeries that the plastic surgeons show you at your conferences where they have these giant flaps and have to remove large portions of someone's face. I think it'll make the surgery much more palatable.
That's really cool, though. If you think about it, neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitor, like debulking people, that sounds really cool. Getting back to basal cell, there's now another one. We heard about vismodegib for a long time. What about sonedegib?
I mean, they're both excellent drugs. Both of them are being used currently, and I think both of them will have relevance in the neoadjuvant mode, which is, for me, what I find most interesting.
And what about tolerability? Because you mentioned the problems that this patient had. First of all, is there any difference between these two hedgehog inhibitors in terms of tolerability, you know, profiles?
It appears that the more recent drugs have slightly better tolerability profiles. There are a lot of problems with fatigue and asthenia with vismodegib. it seems like they're a little better tolerated, no question.
What about this? You mentioned lack of appetite, but what I actually heard about was so-called dysgeusia, where food doesn't taste good. Is that what they tell you?
Well, but when the food doesn't taste good, they lose their desire to eat, so they just don't have an appetite. It just tastes terrible. It has this horrible metallic taste, which can happen, by the way, with interferon. Sometimes it can happen with checkpoint inhibitors, but it's a very common phenomenon with hedgehog inhibitors.
With checkpoint inhibitors, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a rare but not unheard of complication, having this metallic taste, but it's just so much more prevalent and common with hedgehog inhibitors.
Anything, incidentally, I know you had a long interest in a lot of publications in terms of the issue of side effects, immune-related side effects of checkpoint inhibitors. I thought I saw that a paper you were involved with some kind of system to monitor for autoimmune side effects. Does that ring a bell?
Well, there are now coming up position papers from ESMO and from ASCO.
Online tool.
Yes, online tools for how to handle the side effects.
ASCO 2017.
Yes, so it's clear, you know, and this contains, it's more management tools than surveillance tools, but there are a lot of things in there that make it clear what the experts do who have been doing this for the last 10 or 15 years should be done in the community, meaning you should, at frequent intervals, you should be talking to patients who are on Ipi-Nivo more than you might have your staff talk to them to find out about side effects, check their endocrine parameters. You should be inquiring about their GI tract, level of energy, and all these things, much more so than, I don't know, let's say you give them a nivolumab alone or pembro alone, and you say, okay, see you in 2 or 3 weeks, and you kind of forget about them. But with Ipi-Nivo, and sometimes with PD-1 blockade alone, you just need to be more on top of the patients. So it's more work for the staff, the nurses, the nurse practitioners.
Well, different mindset, too, in terms of the whole pathophysiology. And that, I mean, we've been conditioned to think about chemotherapy and that profile, and here we're looking at something totally different.
Yeah, well, the example, Neil, is that patient who came to me who had been treated by a community doc who probably wasn't quite as experienced. I don't think the institution where they were treated didn't pick up on the hypophysitis quickly. I mean, the first thing that someone here at NYU would think about would be, oh, my goodness, do they have an endocrinopathy? It's always the first thing you think about with fatigue, low sodium, that kind of thing.
Right. I was thinking about that case also. I'm going to hear you about a couple other cases. We were talking about adjuvant therapy. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your 37-year-old man.
So yeah, I was a 37-year-old guy with stage 3C disease. He was on nivolumab. And then he had a pretty long-term therapy. He was out at 9 months doing great. He was actually on a clinical trial. And then he developed these myalgias, and they slowly got worse. And he was a pretty tough guy. He was a relatively young guy in good physical shape. And then he said that he was playing soccer with his kids one day on a Friday. And then the next day he woke up, he had pain in his left lower knee. You know, he had then I saw him the next Monday and was a little concerned that slowly but surely the myalgias had gotten worse. His CPK was slightly elevated. I decided he probably had a little bit of myositis, but it wasn't disabling. He got a brief steroid taper. And then his pain just got worse and worse in the left knee. And I got him an MRI of the knee and sent him to one of our orthopedists. And he had this weird stress fracture of his tibial plateau. And I spoke to the orthopedist, who said, we don't see this in young people. This would be almost unheard of in a 37-year-old. So I had to make the executive decision, am I going to continue or am I not? Do I figure this was an unlucky guy who was kicking a ball with his kids and had some weird fracture unrelated to treatment, or was this all treatment related? I elected to stop him and take him off treatment. And then more than a year later, the guy's fine. So I hope I made the right decision. Although remember, with adjuvant therapy, with melanoma, you're never really out of the woods. But if he gets 5 years without a relapse, the vast majority of relapses would have occurred by 5 years. So it's the toxicity issues get even more complex in the adjuvant mode. But this guy, he has a 70% chance of relapse, but he has a 30% chance that he's cured just sitting there. So you got to be careful how you judge the risk and the benefit.
Absolutely. But I mean, on the other hand, how much treatment did he actually get?
He got a fair bit of treatment.
So, he And maybe
you got
that's
9 months worth of therapy.
Nine months, who knows? We'll never see that trial in 9 months versus a year. But I mean, pathophysiologically, what do you think was going on? You said you don't see it in young people. Do you see it in the elderly?
He said this is something you would see in a patient in their 70s or 80s.
So what do you think was going on pathophysiologically?
I think that he had some inflammatory component either in the joint or in the soft tissues with the myositis, and I think that led to weakening of his underlying bone structure and led to the stress fracture. I think that this was somehow auto-inflammatory, and off treatment, he slowly is getting better. His fracture is healing, or he got better. I mean, he was off for a while, but it took like 6 months for him to feel that he could go out and play soccer again with his kids. And I said, no soccer for at least 6 months. And now he's more physically active and he's fine.
Wow, really interesting. It also brings up sort of a generic question. You're kind of the dean of autoimmune toxicity with melanoma or in checkpoint inhibitors in general. Do you think that in people where you see autoimmune toxicity, that in some or many of these cases, what's going on is sort of the activation of subliminal autoimmune diseases these people have that aren't clinically manifest?
I would agree, and there is a colleague of mine, Iman Osman, at my own institution, who's been exploring seromics. That is, she looks at the existing, pre-existing autoantibodies, and she finds certain types of autoantibodies appear to be more elevated in those who have autoimmunity than those who don't. And she even has a mouse model with a human Fc receptor knocked into the mouse, where she can give the serum, or she can purify antibodies from the patients, give them to the mouse and reproduce some of the side effects. That's very interesting. And we're going to try to work on understanding with her, how can you profile patients pre-treatment and predict who's going to have side effects?
So let me ask you about your last really interesting case, but another thing just popped into my head. I'll just throw out there, CAR-T in melanoma.
CAR-T in melanoma has not really panned out. In fact, CAR-T cells in solid tumors has not been that promising. As you know, there have been two CAR-T treatments approved by the FDA at a phenomenal cost. One is pediatric ALL, the other is adult hematologic malignancies. And solid tumor CARs have not been that promising. One of the more promising ones so far is the folate receptor in ovarian cancer, and that's the subject of an ongoing trial.
CAR-T?
But yeah, with CAR T cells, because the folate receptor.
Because I heard about, like, I think it's mirvetuximab is antibody drug conjugate, but this is CAR T you're talking about.
This is CAR T cells against the folate receptor, which is highly overexpressed in ovarian cancer.
Right, right. Yeah, they have this antibody drug conjugate.
Yeah, with CAR T, you need a cell surface molecule that's recognized by the antibody piece of the CAR T cell to transduce a signal into that T cell. So again, there are not that many absolute tumor-specific cell surface molecules easily recognized by an antibody. Those that are often are present in normal tissues, and you get all this off-target toxicity. So the folate receptor looks interesting. It's something that I think is being pursued, but I wouldn't hold your breath in melanoma.
So let's finish out. I'm just curious about your 45-year-old man. This sounds really fascinating with the scleroderma.
Oh boy, that was a tough one. He came to me with scleroderma and melanoma because his rheumatologist felt this was paraneoplastic. And his rheumatologist was a very experienced woman who's been doing this for 30 years. And she has a good reputation in the community. And I figured, yeah, and she was probably right.
So this patient had multiply relapsed melanoma and the scleroderma syndrome?
So he had multiple melanomas, relapsed, rendered free of disease, and finally relapsed in his chest wall with multiple subcutaneous nodules, multiple lymph nodes, obviously could not be rendered free of disease surgically. He comes to me and only relatively recently, over 6 to 8 months, had had the scleroderma. And I spoke to the rheumatologist and I said, give him the least immunosuppressive influence you can. And she gave him hydroxychloroquine, which has modest immune suppressive activity, but can help with diseases like scleroderma.
How is the scleroderma manifest?
Oh, his skin on his arms, his hands, and his shins was like leather. And it was his feet, it was painful to walk.
Have you seen this before with melanoma?
I have never seen a case of scleroderma like that.
Wow.
It is not an association with melanoma, that I can say for sure. Hydroxychloroquine can control the disease. It's a pretty modest immune suppressant. I gave him the Pembro, and he slowly had his scleroderma get worse and worse and worse. and the skin is so fibrotic on the knuckles, the skin breaks, so he has to put Band-Aids over his knuckles. It spreads to the esophagus. It doesn't have motility that's as good as it used to be, so it's hard to swallow large amounts of food. You have to really cut your food up.
And just to mention, I see he's BRAF wild type.
Yeah, and he's BRAF wild type. It would have been so easy to give him BRAF MEK, obviously. I had hoped he was BRAF mutated, but he was wild type, of course. So with some reluctance, I gave him Pembro every 3 weeks. And he got out to 6 months, and I think his tumors completely regressed. The current scan shows no obvious evidence of disease, no evidence on exam, but his scleroderma slowly got worse. His legs are swollen, lower extremities are swollen. He has to wear different types of shoes. He's a school teacher and still goes to work every day to teach, but it's hard to stay on his feet because his feet hurt. I said, look, this is really affecting your quality of life. You have no obvious disease. Let's quit and give you 12 weeks off, a drug holiday. Let's put you on moderate dose steroids, keep up the hydroxychloroquine, and his doc added mycophenolic acid. And I'm going to see if we can make his quality of life better off pembrolizumab. But boy, what am I going to do when he relapses?
Well, first of all, it sounds like this is not a paraneoplastic syndrome.
No, I don't think it is.
So he just probably has scleroderma.
I think he has scleroderma. If it was paraneoplastic, it would have gotten better with tumor regression.
Yeah. Well, what do we know? I mean, I was going to actually ask you what was new in terms of giving checkpoint inhibitors to people with autoimmune disease, but specifically, what do we know about scleroderma? I'm not sure I've seen anything on that.
Well, first of all, it's not that common a disease. Second of all, the only experience that's published is anecdotal, plus a couple of small series, one of which was published a year or so ago by Alex Menzies, who's from Australia, good young guy. And Menzies probably treated around 50-some-odd patients who had various types of autoimmune diseases. And actually, of the 56, only 3 or 4 of them flared so badly he had to stop the PD-1 inhibitor or ipilimumab. He tried both. Ipi was worse, caused more problems. Pembro or Nivo was better, which makes sense. They're more directed. And the bottom line is you can actually amazingly get away without killing somebody who has an autoimmune disease by using PD-1 inhibitors. I sure as heck would not give ipi-nivo to someone like that.
What about scleroderma specifically? Does that flare when you give a checkpoint inhibitor?
Well, in this guy, I think he slowly got worse.
But what about in this other series? Do they have any scleroderma patients?
I don't think he had scleroderma patients who flared. He did have scleroderma patients, and he thought that they were quiescent.
So we actually had a case come up in lung cancer where the patient had a long history of ALS, and they wanted to know, could you give a checkpoint inhibitor? Because I had heard previously that people are very, very nervous about giving it to MS. So what about those two entities?
Well, the only time I've ever treated someone with MS with immunotherapy was high-dose IL-2, and amazingly, I got away with it, but they did not have severe MS. Someone who has progressive, not relapsing, remitting, but progressive severe MS, I think you could kill them by giving them serious immunotherapy.
What about ALS?
Boy, that's even tougher. It depends on how sick they are.
But I mean, is that immunologic?
It may, we assume it probably is.
Is that right? Is the thinking ALS is immunologic?
It may be. And you would have to really push me to give someone with ALS immunotherapy. But if they did not have severe ALS, meaning they weren't at the point of being paralyzed, having breathing issues, I would gingerly, and they had no other options, and they were going to die of melanoma, I would try pembrolizumab or nivolumab. I wouldn't give the combo.
That's kind of the thing that I've heard a lot about in a patient, and we're not talking about adjuvant situation, but in a patient with metastatic incurable disease regardless, that it's consideration, but it seems, I do hear that people, whether it's Crohn's disease or whatever, that people are okay if they're not getting biologic therapy or aggressive therapy, they're stable, but they start getting very uncomfortable if they require more extensive therapy. Is that kind of the way you approach it?
Yeah, I would agree, Neil. And if I see a patient with active autoimmune disease, I cross my fingers and toes and hope that they're BRAF mutated so I don't have to think about giving them immunotherapy up front. I just had someone with active colitis. I had him come off steroids and go on vedolizumab, which is the alpha-4 beta-7 integrin antibody, which can control colitis without really being grossly immunosuppressive. And then I put him on BRAF-MEK. Thank God he was mutated. But if he fails BRAF-MEK, I'm going to have to take the plunge and give him Pembro or Nivo. That's going to be tough.